Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today I'm delighted to be joined by Colin O'Neill. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Pill Eve, and Gotham Chebrelew. He is the Founder and Chief Technology Officer of Pill Eve. Gotham, Colin, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us, Dr. Nick.
So as I do with all of my guests, I think it's always important to get a little bit of the background. Gotham, I'll start with you because you're founder on the organization. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you arrived at this point, if you would.
So I studied biomedical engineering, and I know a lot of people in your audience probably have a healthcare background. And personally, I actually didn't think about starting a company. I'm relatively young. And when I met my co-founder, Yusuf Albanawi, we ended up meeting on the point of our own personal experiences with substance abuse, and that's either personally or with our family. And at that point, it was really just, we wanted to do something because we kept hearing about the opioid epidemic, and we decided, why don't we just start a project? Why don't we try to include friends and family members? Because the key term that kept popping out to us was early intervention. And so we just wanted to do something, and then we just kept on working on it, starting talking to a lot of doctors, a lot of pharmacists, a lot of patients, everywhere, all these stakeholders, and we started to realize that we actually had something of value. And then that's when we just went for it.
Fantastic. And Colin, tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up here.
Yeah, I'm a pharmacist of about 20 years at this point. And I had just wrapped up my MBA at Babson up here in Boston in the Wellesley area. I was working with Mass Challenge. And both Yusuf and Gotham had approached me with this idea. And it really seemed to resonate with me just based on my experiences and seeing how the practice and the profession of pharmacy had kind of reacted to the opioid epidemic. This was a great opportunity to move something along that could have significant impact in trying to combat that. And so it just kind of blossomed from there. I started as an advisor for about a year. I was chief operating officer with them for about a year. And now I recently took over as chief executive officer for about 3 or 4 months now.
Fantastic. So help us understand, set the stage. I mean, I think people know, but we've, I think, partially lost a little bit of sight of the challenge of the opioid epidemic because we've got a pandemic on our hands. But this continues, you know, it doesn't matter what else is going on. We have the challenge of the opioids. We've had some recent announcements. I'm not even sure where we are with some of the settlements. We're not going to cover any of that. But tell us some of the sort of compelling statistics around this epidemic from your perspective, as you've seen it.
So, you know, in 2015, there was over 12.5 million misused opioid prescriptions. And in 2018, there was over 70,000 opioid related overdoses. So and these numbers continue to grow. So there isn't more recent published information on this. As we continue to interact with different doctors and different patient groups, this is a continuing challenge that hasn't been met. And one of the things that we find interesting is the clinical need hasn't really changed. There's still a need for advancement in that space to help improve patient oversight, help build communication, the relationship between their prescriber and the patient and the pharmacy.
And as you think about the contributory causes, and I know there are lots of them, tell us a little bit about where you think, if there is a majority, or maybe it's equally spread, what contributes to this opioid epidemic that we're seeing?
There's just so many. And I think that's one of the core ideas behind this, is that we need to start understanding the individual or understanding the root cause for each individual, because it may be different. And so that's kind of built into the design. And I know I'm jumping the gun a little and talking about what we're doing, because that's all I think about for the last 4 years. But it's it's all about how do we get just an understanding of the patient so we can go from there. And that's the baseline. And so some people might have taken OxyContin from an uncle when they were hurt playing tennis, or someone might have used it recreationally with a group of friends before they knew the total risk of it, or maybe they were prescribed it. And so there's so many different entry points that all we know is at this point, we need to make sure to help the people that need to get help.
And I think you're teasing out something that, you know, sometimes strikes people as unusual in this space. There's a significant proportion of people that are not buying or getting these drugs illegally, so to speak. And by that, I mean, they're not going and buying it across, you know, some street corner or that process. It's coming through what I would call regular channels. Is that true?
Exactly. And that's, it's a little bit of a mix here, because there's this data that we have, because of course the data is not going to be perfect. It's going to be usually from the National Survey of Drug Use. And so it's going to be a little bit subjective and it won't hit every single marker. But we actually do see that a majority of people who end up abusing heroin later in life, they actually start off with the prescription pills, but they also, a majority of those of that proportion actually get it from beg, borrowing, and stealing. So in a sense, it may not be illegal, but sometimes it's not perfectly legal.
Interesting. So what you're saying is beg, borrow, and steal is the on-ramp to some pretty significant challenges for individuals around opioids and abuse of drugs.
Exactly. Because from our understanding of the problem, the biggest source of extra pills in the community is diversion. And so it's people who have legally obtained prescriptions, and then those pills somehow get out into the community. Yep. And that's something that's kind of lost in the narrative about the opioid epidemic.
So, Colin, you've practiced as a pharmacist. You've obviously been, you know, knee deep in pills, let's call it. tell us a little bit about your experiences on the front line. What did you see? You, I'm guessing, lived through some of this experience from a pharmacist perspective. Were you seeing these this activity, or was it hidden?
So I've worked in a variety of different settings, retail, hospital, long-term care, nuclear, at a variety of different levels, from, you know, student, intern, pharmacist, management director, VP, all these different roles. And it permeates throughout a couple of different things, or I guess there's a couple of different aspects to take into consideration. Some of it is kind of hidden and kind of within the system, a general healthcare system. But there's other things that you see, especially in the retail setting, you know, cash paying customers coming in on a regular basis, picking up large quantities. And so, you know, being able to identify those patients, connecting with those doctors, and then within the pharmacy industry itself, being able to alert, you know, authorities as to, you know, things that you might think would be illegal activities like fake prescriptions and things like that. So these are things that are, these aren't hidden things. These are things that are out in the open, and I think remain out in the open, but are kind of swept to the side. In some cases, I think it's business oriented. I think sometimes, you know, it's customer service oriented, but I think we're doing a very good service for our customers if we're helping them with a problem or a diversion of narcotics.
All right. So substantial problem, clearly multiple on-ramps. You know, I think diversion of existing supply, let's call it legal supply for the purposes, and I know there are variations and a theme here, but you've developed a solution that really goes after that in an unusual way. Tell us about the genesis of that and where you are with that. Gotham?
Yeah, to be honest, the first idea that we came up with was just a way to connect friends and family, because it was all about a support network. Because when it we were also seeing all these studies about how maybe when people were getting addicted in West Virginia, that part of that opioid inclination or inclination to use opioids came from depression, which also came from loneliness. And then there were also studies in rats showing that when rats didn't have a social network around them, that that's when they would actually get addicted to these certain substances. And so there's so many more sociological and psychological factors in this. And so that was a real critical idea for us. But then as we started talking to more and more people, we realized that the doctors should be in the know as well, because the doctors are the ones that are providing the care. And if we can just understand exactly how patients are using their medications, we can definitely intervene as early as possible. And then, of course, on the side benefit of that, of what you're just mentioning with diversion, that if we know exactly where those pills are going, then we know where they're also not going. And so they're not going into the community, which I believe is, at the end of the day, the most important part.
Yeah, and kind of building on what Gotham was saying, you know, it's about right-sizing the prescription, and that's done by improving the communication between the patient and the physician. Right now, when the patient picks up that prescription at the pharmacy, they go out into the community, it's almost an unknown for a couple of weeks until the office either follows up or the patient comes back for a follow-up. With our platform, the patient is able to accurately, record, their experiences with the medication and provide feedback around, how many tablets they're utilizing. Our goal is not to kind of regulate the patient or prevent access. And in fact, it is the opposite of a safe. It's there to actually improve medication access, especially in patient populations that require regimens that are outside the usual guidelines. A lot of these patients have been cut off or dose reduced through their primary care or through their pain physician. And that doesn't stop their need for pain relief. And so they're going through other channels, sometimes not legal channels, to find those medications. And it just adds additional risk for receiving care that they shouldn't have to take on, at least here in the US in this day and age.
So for those of you just joining this week, I'm joined by Colin O'Neill, the Chief Executive Officer of PillEve, and Gotham Chebrelew, the founder and CTO of PillEve. We were just talking about their device. We'll include that in the show post that goes out, but it's focused on impacting that source of diversion and the original way in which some of these drugs enter an abuse opportunity. Colin was just describing, the multiple variations. I think at this point it would be really helpful to explain the device. So I've had the fortune of trying this out. I think clever, intuitive. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah. So from a technical standpoint, and then Colin can go more into the clinical, but the thing that underlies every single part of the device is about how we're integrating into existing workflows. And so if we start with the pharmacy, we actually made sure that our device is just an attachment to existing prescription vials. So pharmacists spend almost no more extra time in just screwing it onto a prescription vial that's already filled with medication, like oxycodone. Then they simply flip it over, put a prescription label on it, and hand it over to the patient. And so now the device is attached to the vial. And then whenever the patient wants their medication, they simply go into an app and then enter in some basic information. So first they authenticate themselves with something like biometrics, like face ID or touch ID, and then simply input information like a pain level, and then press a button to send a Bluetooth signal to the device. And then the device just dispenses one pill at a time. And then by doing that, we're able to get accurate and real-time data that we collect and immediately send over to our web portal that physicians can access at any point. And then also we have some kind of alert. So if there's a tamper event, for example, if someone messes with the vial and opens it up when they're not supposed to, then we get an alert and that automatically is sent. So we understand exactly what is happening at any point. So just to recap real quick, is that for the pharmacist, it's pretty much exactly the same as they're just replacing their normal vial cap with our device. The patient, it's actually, I broke my arm 4 years ago, and it's actually easier to open up, to get a pill out of our device than it is for me to like try to squeeze open a normal vial and get a pill of oxycodone. And so they just press a button on the app. And then for the physician, all the data comes to them in real time, and they don't have to waste time educating the patient or wasting a lot of clinical time that's better spent on doing their job better.
And then kind of turning the page into the clinical implications, first and foremost for the prescriber and the practice, they have better insight into how the patient is utilizing their breakthrough pain medication, whether it's in a post-surgical setting or in a chronic pain setting. They have an idea of, the access. And then also in chronic pain, patients are usually on multiple medications, usually a long-acting med. And so as they're titrating the patient up or down, if they're trying to taper, they have an idea of how often the patient's accessing that breakthrough pain medication. And then, for the patient, we found that it actually gives patients pause for thought. Just the knowledge that, it's being recorded, and that we're trying to fish out functional and subjective pain levels. It kind of improves the feeling of care and concern that's there, but also gives them pause for thought before they take the medication. We've had a couple of patients where we observed where they started to decrease their medication, breakthrough pain medication slightly, and they've taken on a slightly higher patient-reported pain level. And so it was kind of an interesting kind of paradox that we saw there. And we've seen this now a couple of times. And so I think it's just knowing that someone's there, that they can keep track of, the platform's there to help them kind of keep track of the utilization at a personal level, and then knowing that they're connected to their prescriber at a kind of a digital level.
And to emphasize how fascinating this is that a lot of these patients Colin is talking about, they had been on opioids for years. And they had been taking a pretty consistent dose, but then after they started using the system, that's when we actually started to see a slow decrease.
It's really interesting. It brings up a couple of points. So the first off, and I think it's worth emphasizing, is that this is a standardized attachment to existing, pill bottle technology. So it can be widely distributed. It's also interesting to know that Gotham must have received an alert when I tampered with the device you kindly lent me, right? So sorry about that, but that's me. I used to take things apart, can't help myself. But as you highlight, a couple of things, some things really strike me. One, this is actually a positive for the elderly who struggle with these really difficult, and it's child safety, which is appropriate. But I saw this with my own mother, a real challenge. And here we are with the solution that is actually directed somewhere else, but I think is going to solve the problem. But I think it's really interesting when you start to monitor, and I know people go, well, that's Big Brother. But it's not. As Colin rightly highlights, this is caring. And having somebody actually paying attention, when you have a full bottle, you just go, yeah, sure, I'll take it. I feel like Gregory House. I'll, take them like Tic Tacs, as he seemed to. But when somebody's monitoring and you're reconciling that against pain level, and what you're saying is you've already seen a decrease, correct?
Anecdotally, yeah. We're in the middle of a variety of different pilots, University of Washington, OHSU, Johns Hopkins, and we recently started one at UMass out in Worcester. Some of those are post-surgical studies. And so we're noting that, the patient's being discharged with a 30 count of oxycodone 5 milligrams. And, the average utilization, these are in small patient populations so far, is between 0 and 5 tablets. And so these are a significant number of tablets that are going out in the community. And I think you touched on something really important, Dr. Nick, is that this is caring. We haven't used that term at Palieve up until you just mentioned it. But I think, a great example that we ran into was we got a tamper event through our platform. And so we just reached out to the patient to try to figure out what was going on, if they're having any difficulties with the device. And she had said that the device wasn't with her, that it was at home. And so but she also said that her daughter was home. And so it kind of put a red flag up to have that discussion at home about, the medication and who was taking it, and kind of dig into that a little bit more. And so there's all sorts of things that we kind of stumble on. It's still very early. We're still ironing out a lot of wrinkles and discovering a lot of things in what areas, you know, this technology can benefit the patient and the prescriber the most. But we keep stumbling into things like that. And this is an area that's been stagnant in pharmacy, delivery of pharmaceutical care for quite a while. And medication adherence really hasn't moved ahead despite a lot of great efforts out there. I think this is another angle of approach that maybe we can get some traction and jump things forward a little bit. And that's why I'm really passionate about being part of Leave and continue to invest time and energy here.
You know, that's the last couple of feet. It's, you know, from hand to mouth that we've just not had. And, you know, there's been other solutions around this. And you still don't know if they took it out and took it, but you at least know that they dispensed it, which, you know, we know 50% of medications don't even get filled, let alone taken, that are prescribed. And, you know, I'm basing my clinical decisions upon 50% people taking. So, you know, extraordinary value. So let's talk, we've got a little bit of time. What are the sort of economics of this? How do we get this so that it's widely available? It's, you know, probably not going to be on everything, but, you know, where it makes sense, how's that going to work? And what's the future hold?
Yeah. We continue to build our book of business. The model is pretty straightforward. The device is currently $50 for the device, and there's a subscription service for the clinic to access data for $20 a month. And there are a bevy of remote patient monitoring codes that are out there that can be leveraged. And so I actually just ran some ROI numbers this week, and if a patient were... if a clinic were to use this with just one patient, we think it's between $1,200 and $1,300 that they can recover after internal labor and cost of the device and cost of the subscription. And so there's a pretty good return on investment that's in there as well, alongside the clinical value of just having better oversight and better knowledge of what's going on with the patient.
So clear economic value that, you know, presents... I guess an easy decision for people to think about. Gotham, in the last few minutes, where do you think this could go? What are the opportunities?
Yeah, we really do want to become the gold standard for all controlled substances. And we're making a lot of changes in the application as well as the device, just to make sure we can adapt to more and more situations. Because I think at the end of the day, it could be a tool to do patient engagement and to make sure that we're understanding, like we keep going back to it, being a caring platform of understanding. And one quick story that I'll say, because I'm really customer service, and it's all about trusting the patient and building that trust between the patient and the physician. Because in today's opioid crisis, that we actually see that you almost have to be suspicious of the patient beforehand and then build trust. But we want to reverse that. And so we also think, looking forward on the horizon, that things like benzodiazepines and Adderall and methamphetamines, those are the next epidemics that are going to happen. And we're not paying attention to them, but they're already happening right now. And so we are always keeping our ear out for those. And yeah.
So I think, you know, truly fascinating. And I would take that and say, gosh, not just controlled substances. I think there's real value to this. I think you can see the economic benefits literally just of knowing. I mean, from a caring standpoint, but also from economics, why bother prescribing something? Why fill it if you're not going to take it? We don't want to. We see all this automated refill in the industry that is driven by economics and say, if I refill it, I get paid because I'm in the pharmacy benefit management, all of those things that I think will drive additional opportunity. It's giving easier access. It's giving a caring sense around this that, you know, starts to focus. And as you pointed out with the rats, you know, people that are lonely and don't have any friends around them are increasingly at risk. And guess what happened in the pandemic? We saw that extensively. So there's huge opportunity for this, for what is, I think, just quite frankly, brilliant design to allow for a capability to use it in different settings, different utility. And I love that story. I know whoever that individual was is eternally grateful to discover that, you know, something is going on at home that they would not have known about. So already one life that's prevented, or at least you've got an opportunity to play intervention. This is an exciting story. I'm glad to be here at the beginning with it, with you at the beginning of it. Just grateful you're able to make the time and indeed hand me a device. I'm just sorry you didn't fill it with M&Ms instead of real drugs, but that's okay. Unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time, but exciting journey. Glad to be here with you. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, The Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.